When I was pregnant with Mayim and my sister Linda, without an R at the end, was driving to La Jolla, my left arm got totally numb and I couldn't move the left side of my body. And I told my sister to turn back and go back to my mother's home where we were staying. And when I got there, my mother was on the floor having a stroke on the left side of her body.
This is one of these like super awesome sort of like Hungarian Jewish witchy moments of my family. There are some. This is my favorite.
I'm Jonathan Cohen and welcome to another Bevisode, a version of Mayim Bialik's Breakdown where we bring on Bev Bialik, Mayim's mom.
Against all our better judgment.
It's Mayim Bialik's Breakdown. She's going to break it down for you because you know she knows a thing or two. And now she's going to break down. It's a breakdown. She's going to break it down.
Please welcome the Sheila to Mayo show, Mayim Bialik.
I think that's my favorite intro you've ever given me. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Remember when we tried to watch the Sheila doc and we only made it about 15 minutes?
Because there was something about it that was not working for
us. I'm circling back, but I like to watch TV in 15-minute increments.
I don't even understand how my ADHD friend exists. But you don't have that diagnosis.
I don't have it
no,
at all.
No, it's not a
thing. I just like to savor good television.
No.
I don't want to, you know, use it up.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Mayim. For people who are listening, this is an exciting episode because Mayim's mom literally talks about having
right off the bat
special psychic or manifestation abilities.
She doesn't call it that, though.
She does not.
And that's actually what makes it most interesting to me.
She calls it mystical powers. And we start to talk about if Mayim might have mystical powers also.
Well, I'm one of those people who, like, my whole life, adults have really liked me. Like, I've always liked talking to adults, and adults always said, like, you're an old soul. And I was always very interested in older people. And people used to say to me, you know, like, those interesting friends of my parents would be like, she's an old soul. And I was like, oh, it's just like, I'm articulate. Like, I didn't really think about it. And then I had, you know, many years later, I had kids, and people started talking about indigo children. And I didn't have spirited children at all. And a lot of times indigo children are like unusual kids who, like, you know, don't like fit the norm. And I was like, that's not my kids. And, you know, but my older son is a lot like I was, and people describe him as an old soul. I mean, a yenta, like, he always wanted to be, like, in everybody's business. But there has been a portion of my family, and in particular my mother's mother's side, like that side of my family, where there always was this element of, like, I don't want to say spooky, but there was something in these women, you know, my mother, her sisters, that are very powerful. And my grandmother was a very powerful woman who was very sad all the time. She had a real heaviness to her, but she also, I mean, we said she had gold in a hent. Like, she was one of those people who could, like, make anything. That's its own kind of magician. Like, that kind of woman in my family was like, she can cook anything. She can bake masterpieces. But she had this very special quality to her. And my mother, like, we never talked about it. When people hear that, they think, like, oh, you were raised by a hippie. My parents definitely had, like, granola features, but it wasn't like we talked about crystals and things. Like, we were a very, like, standard American immigrant, you know, struggling family.
So I talk a lot about generational traits that get passed down.
Yeah. Well, generational trauma and also generational traits.
Generational traits, generational trauma, yes. I also talk about that as a representation of our devotion to that family, because we are a loving entity of that family. We will carry forward traits to show them that we are connected, even if those traits do no longer serve us.
This is like some of the ancestral work that, like, when I've gone to healers or when you've gone to healers, they talk about, like, you're carrying. And I'm like, what? I don't know.
And it's all because we want to be a part of a loving collective. And so a survival mechanism or a character trait that has served an ancestor may be representing or presenting in us and not be effective.
In ways that are not advantageous. Also, in the Jewish tradition, I mean, in my family in particular, there's different traditions even among Jewish naming practices. You are named for someone to carry on, like, literally carry on their spirit and their qualities. And so it's...
But we have to be careful with that, because we want to carry forward the positive qualities and leave those qualities that are more troubling.
She had no waist.
Is that what you're carrying?
I'm a little worried that I lost my waist. I think it because the person I'm named for.
And in all seriousness, though, you have a company called Sad Clown. And you talked That's about this true. Very sad grandmother.
No, it was very, I mean, look, there's a lot of tragedy, you know, in my and many people's families, you know, especially if you come from like the Holocaust and that generation. But yeah, I love this notion, though, that, you know, people have told me, like, why aren't you harnessing your power? Like, I've had more than one healer say that to me. And to be honest, it's like, whatever. Like, they're just saying that because, like, I'm paying them. I mean, that's my fear. Like, my cynical fear is like, oh, they say this to all the girls. Like, you've got power. But I will say that giving birth is a mystical experience, like, is a completely transformative mystical experience. Becoming a parent, you know, and taking on that responsibility in the way that I chose to, and I guess continue to choose to. But my younger son, like, we always used to say, like, he sees dead people. You know, he had an experience with the universe that made me believe in something for sure.
Can you feel energy in your hands?
No, I really don't. I feel inappropriately connected to other people's emotions. And I do, even though I'm not like a I believe in past lives person, when I have had, you know, when I've gone to some of the alternative practitioners I've gone to, they have, you know, pretty consistently indicated that I hold some kind of information and that I have some way to be a sort of conduit for that. But I don't, like, to me, does that mean like, oh, that's why I became famous and now I have a podcast about mental health so I can like help one person get help? I don't know what that means. I guess here's a question for you before we bring on my mom to talk about this and many other aspects of her reflections on some of these episodes. You are a person who is trained tens of thousands of hours.
Yes.
In a certain kind of understanding of things that occur in the universe that we can't necessarily put a formula on or take a picture of.
Correct.
Okay. So do you walk around with a sense of like, I'm a walking healer and I'm walking among you?
No, absolutely
Why
not?
Why not? I feel like I want you to.
I mean, it doesn't even occur to me. I don't even like the word healer. But I have been a part of sessions, workshops. I've experienced things that have made me believe that what we currently experience with our five senses is only part of the story.
But you're more tuned in than other people.
And that science is only beginning and is
true.
Very quickly catching up. It's not that like I think that, oh, you think something and it immediately happens, but I do believe that.
Wait till you hear what Bev says.
Sometimes our thoughts and our emotions are indications of other information that we may be getting.
Okay, but I think you're being overly humble because I can believe that, but it doesn't mean that I know what to do with it. Like, you know what to do with. Like, you see things that other people don't see.
So here's why I don't consider it, because I've gone through different periods of my life where I've been like really immersed in it and, you know, meditating twice a day, three times a day, and like opening up those senses to feel more, to experience more. And in those time periods, it's like a switch that I could flip where I'm like, I'm walking in the normal world. Oh, wait a second, let me tune in. And I use that word tune in because it's like, just like you would feel something, oh, you're going to open up a sense and you're going to utilize it. And when I'm not doing that and I'm sort of functioning in the ordinary world, like you have to function, you have to like go buy an apple and you have to buy potatoes and you have to cook a meal. And
you
like,
buy a lot of potatoes.
I love potatoes. Sweet potatoes only though, because they're low glycemic index. But the point of this is that like to operate only in this mystical realm of like, I'm going to tune in and see if you have a chakra that's out of alignment. Now we can even argue if chakras are real or they're imagined. But like, I do believe that people have an energy around them.
Okay. This is a lot more than we can tackle here, but I will say,
do you not believe that people have energy fields around them? You just think that there's like,
I mean, I don't know.
Like even there's heat. You sit next to someone and your arm is next to them and they have a heat to them. There is a biochemical.
I can buy that. There's heat.
What about grounding? You've done a visualization where you've seen yourself rooted into the ground. You've done another one where you've brought from the top of your head all the way to the sky.
I love those.
So are those just visualizations?
Maybe.
Are you actually making a connection?
I don't think you actually make a connection. I don't know.
Well, this is what I'm saying.
See, this is why when people are like, you have power, I don't know that I do. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it.
Maybe you have great power that is just not practiced in any sort of...
Great lead-in to welcoming Bev, because one of the things, my mother like literally deals it to me. She analyzes very specifically, as if she's been waiting to tell me this, why I'm not tuned into it. So with that,
let's welcome Bev.
Break it down.
Bev, welcome back to the Bevisode episode, well, I guess Bevisode number 4. What's exciting that we should start off with is if you go to Google and you put the word Bevisode into Google, you are the top 2 results.
What do you mean?
Obviously, oh, you haven't tried it.
This is the episode. Is Jonathan's going to explain what he means, and I'm just going to sit back and listen.
Jonathan Explains Google is this episode. So we created a word, Bevisode, which is episode but for Bevs.
I get it.
When you put that into Google, it's often hard to get to the top of Google search results, but this is so unique, as are you, that you actually are trending at the top of Google.
I like it. Trending. Okay.
Trending.
I like it.
Mayim, where should we start today?
Let's touch on the Elizabeth Bochner episode. Now, Elizabeth Bochner was my doula for my birth with Fred. And she received a calling, really in a dream, if I remember correctly. Have you ever had any dream like that, that inspired you to do something?
Not when I'm sleeping. I've had them when I'm waking.
Waking dreams?
Mm-hmm.
Are those are different than sleeping dreams?
I would say so, because I'm conscious, but it's a sense of a calling, but I'm conscious of it.
How do you receive that information? Like, describe what that's like.
It's like an aha moment when you suddenly feel that you're intended to move in another direction and follow a different path.
Is there any examples?
When I was pregnant with Mayim, we were in San Diego, and my sister, Linda, without an R at the end, was driving to La Jolla to meet a doctor. Because I couldn't get back to LA. And my left arm got totally numb and I couldn't move the left side of my body. And I told my sister to turn back and go back to my mother's home where we were staying. And she said, don't be ridiculous. We have a doctor's appointment for Mayim, an obstetrician. We're going to be late. I said, no. We need to go back to mommy's house. And when I got there, my mother was on the floor having a stroke on the left side of her body.
This is one of these like super awesome sort of like Hungarian Jewish witchy moments of my family. There are some. This is my favorite.
I mean, if I hadn't turned back, I don't know what would have. She was on the floor having a stroke and we had to rush her to the hospital, et cetera, et cetera.
What do you attribute the cause of that, like knowing in that moment? Like, how do you explain that?
I think Mayim was right. It is the Hungarian blood. but I also think, and I think this of all women, not just pregnant women, I think all women are vessels, and the body, whether they're pregnant or not, or have children or not, the vessel that it is holds a lot of information from the universe. And I think I was tapping in at that moment, kind of like the ground breathing, but in a different way. And I literally felt that vibration going through and have to turn back. But I think it was the pregnancy in that case that gave me the extra sensory power. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you connect with having the ability to tap into universal energy or knowing in other times in your life?
Okay, this is new to me. What do you mean?
Well, you don't have to know everything, Mayim.
Apparently not.
But yeah, I mean, I do. So this has been for a long time. If I paint something, like I'm in my studio and I paint, and I've told you this, I paint a clawfoot tub, the four-legged clawfoot tub, the old ones, the vintage ones. And I'm painting a scene from my childhood. The next day when I go into a thrift shop, which normally sells only clothing, there will be a tub that I painted for sale in that shop that day. Just this week, I was telling a story about an accordion somatic kind of body feeling in my abdomen. And I was working with the somatic body therapist. We were working on the accordion squeezing. We worked through it. The next day, I went to the thrift store. There was an accordion in a box on the floor.
So here's the question. And this comes straight out of the Matrix. If I hadn't mentioned it, would you have knocked over the lamp? Or the vase is the scene. And people who have seen the Matrix will understand. I'll explain it here.
And you lost me with the Matrix. I don't know that.
The Matrix is a movie about kind of an alternate perception of reality. It's very trippy. Okay. So Keanu Reeves' character, he's trying to figure out if he's the chosen one. So he goes to this oracle, who's this old lady baking cookies in her kitchen. And she kind of looks him over and she's like, "You're not it." And he's like, "I didn't think I was." People who are really experts are going to be like, "That didn't happen." And then she says, "And be careful, you're going to knock over that vase." And he says, "What vase?" And he knocks over the vase. And so she says to him, "The real," you know, he's like, "How did you know that was going to happen?" And she said, "The real question is,
would you have knocked it over if I hadn't said anything? Or would you, or so?" And that's the thing, is like, would you have seen the accordion otherwise, or would you just have noticed it because you were talking about it?
It's not like when you buy a green car and you see only green cars. It's not like that. It's not. It's like it kind of like comes out of my head and becomes a thing once I either paint it or say it. It's happened too much.
I just want everyone to be clear on what's happening. She thinks that she has a power. She paints it and it happens.
She has a manifestation power.
But I didn't grow up with a mom who I thought like that.
I wasn't painting then.
When did you start painting and manifesting things through your painting?
I started painting
when my father died.
About 3 years or 4 years ago, after Barry passed away. I've never painted before.
Maybe you could paint my father and bring him back. I kind of miss him.
That would be good. Yeah.
When you go into your painting mode, do you sort of clear your head and have a blank slate and allow the universe to put whatever image is in there?
I always paint from what I see in my head, not from any paper, or not that I'm saying it's good, or, you know, I'm not judging people who do, but I always paint something I've either seen on the news in the morning or something I thought about in a dream. That's how I paint.
And do you think that Mayim has inherited this Hungarian superpower?
100%. She might not be utilizing it yet because you need a lot of spare time. She doesn't have any.
Interesting.
And often if you have a superpower like this and you're not utilizing it or harnessing it, it can actually be somewhat overwhelming or confusing because you're getting a lot of information and you're not necessarily organizing it.
You know, I don't like the term superpower. It's kind of more mystical. It's a little bit more mystical than superpower.
I've been told by more than one healer that I have power that I am not using.
And I just said the same thing. Mm-hmm.
So it must be right.
All right, moving on.
I wanted to make a correction, if I may. So Jonathan asked me if I thought you were empowered. And I said no, because I said it had a haughty air to it. So I think what I meant was you're empowered, but you're not entitled.
Okay.
Does that make more sense?
Yes.
But maybe not empowered fully to utilize all of her mystical capabilities.
Different empowerment.
My Bialik's Breakdown is supported by Think.
You ate all the Think bars.
I ate every single one. I even tried to take them away from my son so he couldn't have any.
Think believes great tasting, nutritious snacks are always a good idea. And by always, I mean he always eats all the Think bars. Their products are packed with thoughtfully delicious ingredients to help fuel your day, because when you give your body what it needs, along with a healthy, active lifestyle, it gives you the strength to help you do the things you love. Stand for strong. Everything you do, you can do stronger with Think. They bring portable protein to fuel your life and power your body. They stand for physical and mental strength. Think offers nutritious, protein-rich, low-in-sugar bars in decadent flavors. You get long-lasting energy for your active lifestyle, or Jonathan's lifestyle. Available in options to fit your lifestyle needs like high-protein, plant-based protein, low-calorie, keto. The plant-based high-protein bar is vegan, soy-free, and they're packed with 13 grams of plant-based protein and only 5 grams of sugar. If you're on the go, need a mid-afternoon snack, crave a pick-me-up before your workout, or want to steal delicious things from your children and your girlfriend, grab a Think bar. Head over to www.thinkproducts.com/breakdown and get 20% off with the coupon code Breakdown. All right, let's talk about an episode that you did not like.
Which one?
Well, I'm going to bring it up because, so Brian Posehn is a friend of mine, so you can't say mean things about him.
I'm not saying any mean things.
Okay. Well, you said there were aspects of him that you really related to, and your text said, maybe I just am really a tall man.
I felt that way when I watched Cheyenne.
Yeah, you have a very special thing with you and Cheyenne. That was, I think, your favorite episode so far.
When Brian spoke about being on the floor in the therapy room, that's exactly when somebody asked me recently about my therapy. Maybe it was you off camera. And I said, I remember being on the floor and playing with toys. And he said the exact same words I said.
Are you talking about being in therapy as a child?
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He, and when he said that, it brought me right back. Like, we had the same experience, verbalized it in the same way. You know, neither one of us thought of sitting at a desk, sitting on a couch.
Right, right. Well, it's, you know, play therapy. So one of the things, and we don't have to dive too deep into this, he actually shared a very kind of intimate struggle that he's had with pot. It's something that I honestly didn't know what he was going to talk about, because he had been a very public person as kind of an advocate for pot smoking, and it was like a big part of his life. And then he also did speak publicly about stopping, but then when we spoke to him, he shared a really intimate thing that this year has been, I mean, the year of the global pandemic was enormous for a lot of people. And many people relied on a lot of things. I've heard a lot of people relying a lot more on alcohol than even they're comfortable with, and pot, you know, also dating apps, you know, food. So I thought it was really brave of him to talk about that. And for people who are addicted, which, you know, there's this kind of notion, and there was this notion when we were kids too, Jonathan, you know, it was like, you can't get addicted to pot. And sure enough, yes, you can, because there is absolutely a chemical addiction. But the way that I describe it is like, you can get addicted to feeling good. And that's what pot does. It makes you feel good. So that's a feeling that many people chase, and many good, decent, law abiding citizens. I mean, it's now legal.
I'm going to really have to take, I really don't agree with that statement. Addicted to feeling good, and it makes you feel good.
You don't think pot makes people feel good?
I think it does until it doesn't.
Well, that's true of food. That's true of sex. It's true of, I mean, it's true of anything. And you can, I mean, as a scientist, I can say you can get addicted to many things, but the loop and the chemical cycle of addiction is alive and well with pot, for sure. And
rather than keeping you feeling good, doesn't just keep you zoned out. And that's not necessarily...
So zoned out is a little bit of a judgment, but yes, it numbs a lot of the intensity of both painful feelings. And also for people who experience mania, it's a mood regulator. So pot is kind of one of those things that, you know, we used to all kind of like shove away. But the fact is, it is a mood stabilizer that many people self-medicate with. And look, now that it's legal, I mean, I've had to have conversations with your grandsons about it, because it's like, oh, it's fine. Everything's fine. Well, no, it is a drug. And here are the things that it does. But you know, alcohol is also a drug, and so is nicotine, you know?
Well, I really felt for him, and I thought he was so genuine, and so, I mean, I really, he seemed to be in pain while he was talking. I don't know.
He said he's very uncomfortable talking about it.
And I'll be honest, I didn't know, and nobody would ever ask, if he had to get stoned to do the podcast.
I mean, the question is it our business, I guess?
No, but I'm just, but
I know many people who need to be stoned to function. I know many people like that. She doesn't like that. Why does it make you uncomfortable? Go on.
The one line that was the giveaway for me that made me uncomfortable, and it was really the only line, it's from my personal, you know, experience, when he said, God, I heard this my whole life. You know, it's not the right time. It's always the wrong. I could do it today, but it's not the right day. Maybe.
So I'm curious, because like.
Never the right time.
Well, right. But to me, that makes 100% sense, because when you have a thing that gives you comfort. mm-hmm. or helps you feel safe, it is very difficult to fly without a net, especially if you have responsibility, if you have children.
It's never going to be a good day to say, I'll stop today.
That's absolutely true, because what's a good day to experience life sober if being sober is so painful, you know? It's funny, I was talking to somebody the other day and she was like, I really want to tell my, I can't remember, it was like husband, boyfriend, whatever. I really want to tell him that he needs to just be sober and I can only be with him. I said, be careful what you wish for. You may not like him sober.
Moving on to Sal.
Yeah, we're doing great. Let's move on to Sal. Jonathan calls him Saul, like he's the king of Israel. You typed salmon, like the fish, but his name is Sal, S-A-L. I thought that that might be interesting to you because I actually thought this would be a good opportunity for you to talk just briefly about your teaching career. Because how old were you when you started in the public schools and the public systems of New York?
I would say that I was, 20.
And the kids weren't that much younger than you.
Now the kids who still write me are grandparents like I am, because they were 6 years younger or 7 years younger. That was like, oh my God. And Barry taught in the same first school I taught at. So we both taught in the Bronx at the same new school, IS-131.
You also taught in the women's prison, correct?
I certainly did. So I taught in the women's prison in the West Village, and I would walk there from our railroad flat and stop at Sutter's Bakery and get a Danish.
Okay, important to know about the Danish, but tell us about working in the women's prison.
So you have to go through a lot of gates. You hear the clanging and the check. Yeah. And I was teaching, and there were very famous murderers there at the time, women. But the girls I was teaching were high school girls, and I was teaching them English. Very important. And, what was so fascinating, and I remember that when they told you what they were there for, and I was never afraid of them or anything. I mean, they were a great bunch of girls, besides the fact that they killed children, they killed mothers, but they would say it just like that. What do you hear? I killed my mother, killed my baby. It was as if they said, I killed a rat in the, there was no remorse that I could see, no residue of any kind of guilt, just very matter of fact.
Why weren't you afraid?
Well, I mean, you hope they were frisked before they came in there. I mean, and there are guards. And I really felt that, I could do a lot of good. And there were always people in the street screaming up at everybody, like you see in the movies. But it was a great job. And I loved going. I loved hearing the clank of those gates. I can hear them today. I mean, there was something nice about being locked in with them. I mean, I was safe in there. That's how I felt. So, but I taught them English, composition, grammar. I always liked creating my own programs. Barry and I had a program, which we started. We had pen pal classes. So my class and his class and Barry's class, they didn't know each other. They wrote letters to each other.
Let's just think of how adorable this is that we have these two teachers who were like kids, my parents. They were also, I think they were like voted like most attractive couple in like one of the like teacher newspapers that I've seen. And they had their like, this was a program nobody was doing. And they taught them to write letters to each other to get to know another kid. Like, it's so cute. Sorry. It's cute.
The cute part and the dangerous part. Then we got on trains and went down to Central Park. That's when you took kids on trains.
No permission slips.
Yeah. And the kids met who their pen pals were and talked with each other and were making out and everything was going crazy. Oh my God. But we got them back. We reined them back in. And so that was a great program. Then I spoke to Mr. Dunn about, I had a title, I love a title and a theme. I had project performance where I would literally pick up about 8 or 10 kids every morning, put them in my car.
Which you cannot imagine getting into a car with a teacher.
8 or 10 kids. What kind of car was it?
It was they're different cars. Yeah.
No insurance, whatever. They jammed them in my car. I drove. And I had to set up. It took me weeks to get them jobs, non-paying jobs in community shops. So one would be working at a candy store. One would work at the newspaper stand. I would drop them off 1 o'clock. I'd come back, pick them all up. And then we'd go back and do the afternoon studies related to their jobs.
So this is also like you know, now it's sort of like, okay, it was like vocational studies. But at the time, you and Dad literally were like, wouldn't it be great if these kids could actually see what it's like to be having jobs and out in the world? It's actually, I mean, it's a great idea. And the kids that they were teaching came from difficult neighborhoods. Like, these were kids who were not getting a lot of the opportunities that kids in the more affluent parts of Manhattan were getting. Like, this was Harlem. This was the Bronx, you know? Let's move on. But I thought that was pretty good for the Sal episode because I had a feeling you would like some of the educational components.
On to Will Wheaton.
Let's talk a little about Will Wheaton. But we're gonna keep it kind of simple because I know this was a really... It was a very emotional episode. I think it was one of the hardest ones for me, personally.
Me too.
But what I think was interesting is his expressing how much he wanted to leave the industry.
Yeah, begging.
Right, like how hard that was. And yeah, I guess I kind of just wondered what you thought of that.
You know, it was so, even taking my own personal experiences out of it, it was so sad to me because a lot of kids started really young, and you know a lot of them, they started too. But he didn't want to do it. And he really felt awkward and he really hated it and he hated every part of it.
He also was very good at it, you know, like
that's unfortunate. But on top of that, to have a father who just didn't like him. So there was obviously no history in his parents of like real mental illness, that just his father hated him.
No, here's the thing. Like, there's always more complexity than I think a lot of people know.
Always look for a title. I guess that's wrong.
Yeah, you like a label. Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to talk off camera about what labels we can give to people. No, I mean, I think that, you know, there's, you know, I'm in my training, we're very label happy. We're very, you know, my therapist accuses me of like really psychopathologizing everybody, everything. I apologize publicly for that. Well, part of it is because I've been in therapy a long time and I've had a lot of labels thrown at me and around me. And the other part is I'm trained as a scientist who is, you know, classifying and numbering and running stats. And, you know, like that's...
You're a little label maker. Label stick it on you. Their back.
The thing about people, it doesn't always fit a label.
Correct. Well, or sometimes it fits more than one label. Anyway, it's funny because Jonathan and I were actually interviewed together on Jeanette McCurdy's podcast. And I don't think you know who she is. She was on iCarly. But, you know, she asked about, like, what would you do? Something like, you know, if I wanted to leave, you know, and I said, I don't think people understand that, like, when you're contracted, it's like a grown-up job that you can't leave, even if you're a child. Like, she was in a situation where she also did not want to continue acting, but when the momentum is there and you're under a contract, and so, like, that's what's so difficult, you know?
I mean, people do leave in the middle of a, you know, but...
Yeah, but you could get sued. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, it's a mess.
All right. This was a great batch of episodes. Jonathan, you want to close us out here?
Bev, do you have some nice things that you've prepared to tell Mayim?
I would always love to tell Mayim nice things.
I can't believe this.
You usually say, tell me.
Well, that's true. Last time you balked a little bit because you said that we should tell you nice things, which I agree that we should.
Listen, the nicest thing Mayim has ever said, I told her, when she said I was like a badass bohemian feminine. You know what? I love that description so much. So I can say to Mayim back at you.
Okay, great. All right, let's lock it out.
From my breakdown to the one I hope you never have. See you next time.
You usually say breakthrough.
She wanted to have a breakdown this time.
Not every time.
Not every time. You're changing it up.
Not every time.
All right.
Keep us on our toes.
All right. From our collective breakdown to the one that Beverly hopes you never have. We'll see you next time.
It's Mayim Bialik's breakdown. She's going to break it down for you. She's got a neuroscience PhD or two. One fiction was, and now she's going to break down. It's